Good evening, everyone. Tonight's talk is called Gods and Ghosts. There's an American TV show that features a man who claims to be a medium, an individual who has the ability to receive messages from people beyond the grave and relay them to their still living relatives and friends. The program is hugely popular, with people from all over the United States coming to participate. Much of the information he provides is humdrum, an old watch down the back of the sofa, initials left in cement in the back garden, childhood memories and the like. Sometimes the messages have a personal nature, a dead father acknowledging his son's achievements, and a dead uncle recounting what his niece got up to at his funeral. In post-show interviews, most seem to be happy with what they heard. It seemed to set their hearts at rest a little. It is possible to become a little blasé, however. One woman expressed her disappointment at what a dead friend had told her, perhaps forgetting that he was speaking from beyond the grave. As for the medium, his view was quite telling. He accepted that much of what was passed on was humdrum. What was important, though, and the real reason for doing what he did, was to let people know that there is life after death. To believe that the death of the body was the end of everything was wrong, and would lead to a rather big surprise once on the other side. The Buddha also refuted this view, but he went much further. His teaching also maintains that life went on before this one. Not only that, but described in detail a 31 different realms in which it is possible to appear, and the conditions needed to determine where beings are reborn. This is the endless wheel of existence called samsara, to which we are bound. Traditional Buddhism has an amazing cosmology of ghosts, gods, demons, devas, and men. Tonight we will look at some of these realms and see how the Buddha's teaching helps us to live happily in them. We will also examine their ultimately unsatisfactory nature and how, through insight meditation, we can make good our escape. The 31 realms fall into three main spheres: the worlds where sensuous craving rules, Kamaloka; the worlds of refined matter, where sensuous craving is absent, Rupaloka; and the worlds where all materiality has been transcended, Arupaloka. The traditional texts offer us a multitude of examples of life in these worlds. The descriptions may not sit well with the modern rationalist mind, but it's important to remember that these worlds do exist, and that the material is used to point out the quality of life in each particular realm. For instance, in the Jataka tales, stories of the Buddha's previous lives, there's an account of a certain King Nimi who is taken on a journey through the hell realms. In one realm, he witnesses black dogs, vultures, and flocks of crows prey upon beings, tearing them limb from limb. In another, bodies all ablaze, lie prostrate whilst being pounded with red-hot hammers. Others lie struggling in a pit of burning coals, and yet more are wrung by the neck and cast into a cauldron of boiling water. There are foul, stinking lakes full of blood, where beings with unquenchable thirst are forced to drink the contents. Everywhere, loudly wailing folk are pierced with spikes, spears, hooks, and barbs, and suffer excessive, sharp, cruel, and intolerable pain. It is the supremely painful nature of experience in these worlds that the descriptions attempt to convey. Beings are reborn in these conditions as a result of evil past actions, and their bodies are regenerated over and over again until the effects of those actions have been exhausted. Hell is the lowest rung on the ladder of existence, and along with three other realms, form what the Buddha called the woeful way. Rebirth in these worlds is conditioned by highly efficient, selfish action. As a result, the states experienced are predominantly painful, with little or no opportunity for creating happy states in the future through efficient behaviour. This is certainly the case with the animal realm. Although seeing the cat stretched out fast asleep in front of the fire might give the impression that its life can be one of luxury, the truth is much different. Close observation of the wildlife in any garden will reveal murder and mayhem on a huge scale, and beings under constant threat for their lives. Truly, this realm is one of struggle for survival. Also included in the woeful way is the realm of the petters, the hungry ghosts. These beings are unable to move onto other planes of existence after they die because of obsessive attachment to sense objects. Here's a traditional description. One kind of ghosts are very thin because there is no food. They are so thin you cannot scrape off a bit of flesh or squeeze a drop of blood out of them. They only have bones and skin that covers the bones. Their eyes are deep and hollow. Their hair is messy and hangs down. Their bodies have an extremely revolting odour. They are greatly troubled in both body and mind. They cry and moan all the time because they are always desperately hungry for food. These ghosts roam the human realm but are invisible to our ordinary eyes. The last of the woeful beings are the Asuras. These dark demons are said to be gods who have fallen from heaven worlds because of fighting. They suffer envy, pride, aggression, and a lust for power. All these realms are part of Kamaloka, the sphere of sensuous craving. This loka also includes six blissful realms as well. These, in contrast, are inhabited by heavenly beings called Devas. The literal translation of Deva is radiant ones. They are said to possess beauty far beyond any humans and live happily without the need to work. Here's a description of a celestial abode. Upon a golden mountain, a mansion lustrous all round, with pools of sparkling water covered with white water lilies. Fanned by a breeze, they waft a lovely fragrance around. Eight-sided pillars made of topaz, crystal, and silver, with pearls and with rubies, are entrance to dazzling rooms of gold filled with sweet music. Gaily coloured floors, delightful. No dust is stirred up there. In this glorious mansion, a Deva youth of great lustre shines forth with beauty like the rising sun. Rebirth in these realms is conditioned by efficient action, and lifespans range from thousands to hundreds of thousands of years. Between this happy existence and the woeful way lies one more world, the human realm. Here, beings experience an approximate balance between painful and pleasant states. Their minds are sharper than those in other realms, and consequently, they are capable of much more serious actions, both ethical and unethical. The human realm is regarded as blissful because it affords the opportunity to follow the spiritual path all the way to enlightenment. Conversely, beings here can also commit the most terrible crimes. Above the worlds of sensuous craving lie the worlds of refined matter, Rupa Loka. Here, beings are gods who enjoy subtle, rarefied states of mind and sublime equanimity. Entrance to these worlds comes through developing skill in concentration meditation. Another five realms, called the Pure Abodes, are inhabited only by saintly beings that have discarded all forms of sense desire. As such, they can never again fall below these realms and will attain full enlightenment there. Above the worlds of form lie the formless worlds, Arupaloka. As the name suggests, these planes of existence are devoid of all matter. Here, beings have transcended even bodies. Existence is pure mind. It is said to be the most exquisite, subtle, and delightful of all mundane experience, and rebirth here comes as a result of achieving the most exalted and difficult meditative states. For many in the West, such descriptions are difficult to accept. Modern society, in the main, disregards all concepts of life beyond this one. The general view could be summed up as, once you're dead, you're dead. This is a materialistic, scientific age, and only that which is provable is regarded as real. So it's understandable that some remain skeptical about this subject. Indeed, many are attracted to the Buddha's teaching precisely because it invites inspection. The Buddha told his followers to test the truth of the teaching for themselves and not to accept blindly. But maintaining a purely skeptical view is unbalanced and can be a huge obstacle to progress on the spiritual path. We need to develop a positive quality, faith. In the books, faith is listed as a beautiful mental factor and is first of the five spiritual faculties. It's not the religious blind faith that leads to so much antagonism in the world. It is a positive state that one will accept on trust what we have yet to see for ourselves. Actually, faith is a very common state of mind. Perhaps there's a problem that needs solving, which initially seems beyond us. It's faith when we think, I'm sure the answer's there somewhere, I just need to investigate. How many of us here tonight became interested in Buddhism because we reached a point where we thought, there must be more to life than this? That sentiment is the arising of faith. This attitude allows us to engage with the teaching. We can get stuck in and find out for ourselves the real value of adopting a more than one life view. So what is the value of a more than one life view? To answer this, we need to understand mundane right view. These five mundane wisdoms are sometimes called the way to heaven, and adopting them helps to ensure our future happiness in this life and beyond. The first is, actions have results. According to the Buddha's teaching, the conditions beings experience now are the fruits of their own previous actions. Selfish actions lead to suffering, while altruistic actions produce pleasant results. This is karma, and its law cannot be broken. It's a fact of mundane experience in the same way that the law of gravity is. Any ethical action taken with a view of self must generate a result that is experienced by the doer. It helps if we understand that we are all interdependent. For example, the lone backpacker, proud of his independence, heads off for 6 months' travel in Asia. But is he really acting alone? Who flew the plane that got him there? Who built the plane? And who served him meals and drinks while on the plane? The list of examples is literally endless. He is, in reality, utterly dependent on the efforts of others. If we separate ourselves off from others in the belief that we are different, or better, or deserve more, then we must understand that this flies in the face of reality and inevitably causes disharmony and conflict. The second wisdom, there is a result of giving, reinforces the truth of karma. We can all draw a picture of the miser who, unwilling to spend on himself or others, lives miserably protecting his wealth, lonely and distrusted by the world. Compare that with the person who gives freely, well respected, sought out, and seems to run into opportunities at every turn. Acting in this way reduces self-concern, lessens attachments, and consequently, we suffer less. It's not just money either. Food, shelter, encouragement, and practicing metta are all forms of generosity. In explaining the benefits of giving a meal to a monk, the Buddha said, "In giving a meal, the giver gives five things to the almsman. What five? He gives life, he gives beauty, he gives ease, strength, and wit. But in giving these, he becomes a partaker in each quality himself, both in heaven and among men." Another extension to the view of karma and interdependence is the third wisdom. There is mother and father. All of us at times must have had difficult relations with our parents, the period of the adolescent rebellion especially. But to maintain a disrespectful attitude towards them, to be rude or wayward, is harmful. Although we may disagree with their opinions or attitudes, they still deserve our respect. They've done so much for us, bearing the pain of bringing us into the world and making enormous sacrifices to give us a start in life. The very fact that we are here walking the path to enlightenment is only possible because of what they did for us. Accepting this and honouring our parents can remove a heavy burden. Karma is one major aspect of mundane wisdom. The other is rebirth. The fourth wisdom is there are spontaneously arisen beings. This view is very much the one being expressed by the medium mentioned at the beginning of the talk. People who hold a one-life view believe that death is the annihilation of everything. So it's essential to pack everything into this life. The key word here is materialism. Enjoy it while you can. Consequently, there is little or no regard for ethical action, because the belief is, once you're dead, there's no comeback. However, these same people often live in denial of death. It's too frightening to contemplate the loss of everything, so the fact of inevitable death is put to the back of the mind and ignored. Compare this attitude to one that is open to the idea of rebirth. Firstly, fear of death, although not eliminated, is significantly reduced. Believing that something persists after death makes life here and now less burdensome. It also teaches us the self-responsibility so lacking in this culture of blame. It means efficient actions will, in time, produce their effect, and those who act inefficiently cannot get away with it. There is scope for results to occur outside this lifetime. The scales of justice do balance. Our whole attitude to what this life represents can change dramatically. For instance, Alan has stated that we can view this world as a school where we learn the lessons we need to learn in order to find true freedom. The fifth wisdom states, there are teachers who know about these things and can show us the way. Without them, we would be truly stuck. They represent living Buddhism and the spiritual life. Efficient action towards such teachers brings very beneficial results. Giving a gift to a teacher is tacit recognition that there are things we need to learn. An honest, open, and earnest approach to the teaching can produce marvelous results. How could a teacher refuse an attitude such as that? Adopting mundane right view leads to an increase in happiness because our actions and behaviour accord with reality. As always with the Buddha's teachings, we need to see its effectiveness. To see its effectiveness, we need to put it into action. If acting out of faith, say, we discover that a generous approach really does yield a sense of well-being, then faith becomes a certainty. Directly experiencing the results of such actions makes acceptance of karma and rebirth much easier. There is another way to erase any doubts about the truth of karma, rebirth, and the existence of other realms, and that's by practicing samatha, or concentration meditation. Through developing states of deep calm and one-pointedness called jhanas, it's possible to experience our own past lives, to see how beings are reborn according to their deeds, or even to visit other worlds. The Buddha developed these supernormal knowledges upon his enlightenment. His disciple, Moggallana, was renowned for skillful use of these powers. For a more recent account, we can turn to Alan's own teacher, Kapaluwado Bhikkhu. In his book, Life of a Siamese Monk, he describes clearly reliving past lives whilst in meditation. Developing the jhanas is regarded as extremely efficient action that leads to rebirth in the higher realms, depending on the degree of skill one has attained. While this may seem an attractive proposition, such rebirth in higher realms is ultimately flawed. Imagine a being having lived a life of generosity and service, and having developed skills in concentration, after death spontaneously arises in a deva realm. Enjoying all the fruits of such a realm, that individual may be less inclined to continue a spiritual way. He or she may even consider this to be an eternal realm, not realizing that even here, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self are the order of the day. It is said that even after a lifespan of thousands of celestial years, once the effects of their good karma are exhausted, beings vanish from the deva realm. They are said to see five signs that their time is up. The flowers round their necks wither and die. Their clothes become dull and drab. They are no longer happy and are restless. The seats and cushions on which they sit seem hot and hard. And finally, they lose their radiant glow and their bodies wither. After that, they simply disappear. To be reborn? Where? With a life of pleasure suddenly taken away and the fruits of good past actions exhausted, that being could end up literally anywhere. This then demonstrates the need to escape the wheel of samsara, because it turns out that even heaven is temporary and unsatisfactory. The Buddha stated that all conditioned existence, even the most exalted, is subject to decay and suffering, and is ultimately uncontrollable. The ultimate security we so desperately seek is not to be found in any mundane world. If we wish to come to the cessation of suffering, then it's through vipassana, or insight meditation, that we make good our escape. The only answer is to repeatedly turn our minds to observation of the three marks in all conditioned phenomena. By applying ourselves in this way, we come to realize through our own direct experience that nothing has a discrete permanent core. Everything, it turns out, is conditioned by something else and arises only to pass away again. All experience, including everything we hold on to as being ourself, is seen to be ephemeral, fleeting, and lacking any fundamental essence. Vipassana meditation takes us beyond the mundane worlds of beings. We see for ourselves the ultimates of existence and experience supramundane wisdom. We come to understand that to think, speak, and act under the impression that there is a permanent separate entity called me is, at the ultimate level, false. And this wrong grasp of reality is the cause of our distress. We are forever attempting to satisfy this self, always trying to find a lasting, safe home for it, unaware that it does not, never did, and never could exist. It is simply false to fact. And as a consequence of this ignorance, actions are performed which then necessitate a result. Birth must take place in order to experience the fruits of those actions, and birth necessarily conditions sorrow, lamentation, grief, suffering, disease, old age, and death. In this way, the process continues ad infinitum. We are caught in the endless wandering through samsara. Through the constant awareness of the three marks, the mind, which for so long has perpetuated this myth of self, finally realizes the truth. At that moment, seeing the peril in samsara and wishing truly to escape, the mind breaks free from its chains and leaps into the beyond, nibbana. Tonight's talk could be summarized like this: cease from doing evil, cultivate the good, purify the mind. This is the advice of all the Buddhas. All action undertaken with a selfish motive will result in painful states like those experienced by the beings in hell, the hungry ghosts, the animals, and the demons. All actions undertaken that promotes the welfare of others will result in pleasant states like those experienced by the celestial beings, the gods and the devas. People in general can't accept life as it is, and instead try to eliminate all outward forms of suffering. In doing so, they attempt to create happiness and security, but instead perpetuate that very suffering because they don't address the underlying cause. Adopting mundane right view can improve our life, but cannot provide any permanent solution. The wise, however, strong in faith, devote themselves to where the real good can be done, in one's own mind, one's own views. Through insight meditation, the limits of mundane life can be transcended. We can realize for ourselves the deepest of all truths, the real cause of suffering and its cessation. The Buddha has given us a wonderful teaching, which can improve our lives now and in the future. But it can also take us beyond all pleasure and all pain, beyond all worlds, beyond all life and all death, and bring us to the end of this incessant wandering. That is nibbana, and that is our true home. Thank you.